The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. It's a Euro special as we look ahead to the domestic leagues in Spain, Italy and Germany. Real looking flat, Barca in crisis. Could there be a surprise winner of La Liga? And how sad are all the centre-backs knowing that Suarez and Costa might be lining up together for Atleti? Bayern score 8 at the weekend, which means they'll score 272 goals this season. Can anyone, brackets Borussia Dortmund, stop them? What sort of manager will Andrea Pirlo be? Please say 4-4-2, hit the channels and win the second balls. Well, could Zlatan win the Golden Shoe, a brace for him on the opening day for AC Milan? Expert opinion on all the above, and if there's time, we can talk ham, water slides, crickets, and the dating scene in Cologne. All that, plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Sid Lowe out in Madrid. How are you, Sid?
I'm all right, thank you, Max. How are you?
Yeah, very good, thank you. Nicky Bandini, nice to see you. How are you?
I'm good, how are you?
Yeah, marvellous. Archie Rintutt.
Very well, Max.
Good. Anything in the intro you'd like to discuss at this stage, or would you like to leave that till the end and perhaps not on the podcast at all?
Well, I will mention, because you've mentioned it in the intro mainly, that I am in the process of undergoing a flat move whereby I'm going to be very, very close to, within a 5-minute walk of the biggest water slide in Cologne.
It's very impressive. How big is the biggest? How big is the biggest water slide in Cologne?
130 meters.
That seems. And what's that? How fast do you do that? Do you do that in, you know, 8.6? Is it quicker than Carl Lewis does the 100?
I think it's quite a windy one. So probably a little bit slower than that. I don't think it's designed for adults, which is the big thing. But I will be taking advantage of it.
Now, when I was away and I listened to the pod, I thought, why can't they just get on with it and talk about the football? Why are they have all this meaningless chat? This is not the Guardian Water Slides Weekly. So,
I would tune into the Guardian Water Slides Weekly.
Probably do better than us, wouldn't it, Nikki? Now, look, Sid, talk about the impact of sort of COVID on all the different leagues. And it seems like years ago that you were locked down and we weren't locked down. And I think perhaps we thought we would never be locked down, and I think we're all very sort of worried about you because it was right at that early stage where people didn't really understand, not that we all understand a lot now. We keep hearing in the UK that we are weeks behind the rest of Europe and we appear to be approaching some sort of second lockdown. Before we get onto the pitch, what's happening off the pitch in Spain?
Well, something very similar. The figures over the summer have been growing and growing. They've reached a point now which is really worrying. There was the announcement of a series of restrictions starting yesterday, but it was announced over the weekend in Madrid, because Madrid, again, obviously, as it was the first time around, has become a focal point of this. And these series of restrictions have been done by neighbourhood. And that's where it sort of falls apart a little bit, because, of course, it's very difficult to control movement with neighbourhoods because you can't effectively build borders from one neighbourhood into another. That has yet to be seen how well or how badly that will work. It's been done according to the neighbourhoods, of course, where the figures are higher. Obviously, because this has happened in the UK as well, what that has ended up doing in a way is having a very, very strong direct correlation to socioeconomic factors. So, of course, it's the more, and while I'm reluctant to use such an easy blanket phrase, but it's the more working class areas where it's happened. But of course, it doesn't necessarily resolve the issue, because these are areas in which they've said, well, you can go in and out to work, but not, you know, to go and have a drink, not to meet up. The number of people allowed in a group has gone down now, I think, to 6. And so we're sort of now waiting to see how much of an impact this has. Because it's so focused on Madrid, that's also led to, as has happened all the way through the crisis, but probably even more so now, that sense of confrontation between the Madrid government and the central government, which are run by different political parties, which obviously doesn't help. And all in all, it's kind of depressing, really. It's really quite a worry.
Nikki, is there a similar situation in Italy?
Yeah, and it's got really sort of fascinating consequences for football specifically. And I thought it was interesting what Sid was saying about disagreements between regional government and central government in Spain, because as people who watched this weekend would have noticed, you had 1,000 fans. There was a hard cap of 1,000 fans let into some Serie A stadiums this weekend, which wasn't the original plan. The original plan was nothing to start the season, and the sports minister had sort of promised that this was going to get looked at, reviewed, potentially by the end of the month. But in the meantime, the same sort of central government sports minister, Vincenzo Spadafora, he granted the Italian Open tennis tournament dispensation to have 1,000 fans at the semi-final and the final of their tournament. Now, the regional government in Emilia-Romagna looked at this and said, well, if you can have 1,000 fans at a tennis tournament, why can't you have 1,000 fans in a football stadium? So they said, well, we're going to say that given that that's the law there, that's now the law here, and we can have 1,000 fans at the games in Parma and Bologna. At which point, the central government, the sports minister, turns around and goes, okay, well, I guess this is the rule everywhere now, because everywhere, every other regional government is starting to look at them and say, well, if they can do it, we want to do it. So it's kind of been, not for the first time in this process with coronavirus, a sort of reverse direction of progress of opening things up. Instead of the central government handing down the decision, you've had regional governments taking their own decisions autonomously and the government as a whole following suit. So football, yes, had 1,000 fans in stadiums this weekend, in the stadiums that were quick enough to respond to that, because that decision only got made, I think, on Friday. But they are still looking in Italy now to expand that further. The idea is still to open things up further and have a decision in the next few weeks that's based more around the capacity of stadiums and what's appropriate for a stadium of different sizes.
And that's kind of what Germany are doing, right, Archie? They seem to be better at dealing with everything, as far as I can tell. But it's a percentage that's allowed in the stadium at the moment.
Sure. So 20% of stadium capacity is the maximum that anyone can let in right now. And 7 of the 9 stadiums this weekend had fans at them. The thing is, everything in Germany is very decentralized. It's all the big decisions health-wise are taken by the states. So that's why in Munich this weekend, there were no fans at the Allianz Arena for the season opener between Bayern and Schalke, even though it was originally planned on the Wednesday that 7,500 would go to the game. In the end, the following day, it was said by the mayor of Munich that it would be sending the wrong signal. And similarly, in Cologne, it looked like 9,000 fans were going to be allowed in. And then the day before, at very short notice, it was called off. But on the whole, I have to say, just going out on the streets now, both in Cologne and Munich, because I was in Munich on Friday night, it felt very much business as usual, just everybody's got a mask on. And it's a bit weird hearing all these stories from Italy, Spain, and even the UK. I went back to London at the beginning of this month, and it seemed ghostly in comparison. So I think that one point that's been raised over here has been the look that it gave with the Bayern and Schalke bosses sitting next to each other without social distancing on Friday night. The sort of example that gave off with even Karl-Heinz Rummenigge, the Bayern chairman, saying that it wasn't a great look. Bit of an understatement. To be honest, it feels a little bit lighter over here, given the way that Germany is not suffering in anywhere near the same way. And yeah, instead, kind of lighter stories such as RB Leipzig replacing their kiss cam with a jump cam over the weekend is the extent of it.
What's the current rules for water slides?
I'm going to find out.
I think even, you know, there was always someone at the top of the slides, you know, who had so much power to say when you could go, right?
Exactly. There was already social distancing on water slides. You had to let the other guy get 10 meters away before exactly. You were allowed to start.
And it was always someone like Mike Dean, wasn't it, who had so much power over that slide. Can we talk then about, the season ahead? And I know they've started. Before we get into detail, give me a percentage chance of a new champion in each league. I'll start, Archie, in Germany. The percentage chance of a new champion. Bayern have won 8 in a row.
5%.
Any advances in Italy, Nikki, on 5%?
Yeah, I think I'd give you maybe 20. I think the margin for error for Juventus is certainly not as big as it has been in some previous recent seasons. They're still the favourite. I still expect them to win. In that 20%, that's 4 times out of 5 I'd expect them to win. But I think it's certainly possible that Inter could get ahead of them.
Sid, how about you?
Well, it depends what you mean, because you say a chance for a new title winner.
Okay, yeah, course... I'm saying okay. So Real and Barca out. Then.
Okay,
your
right.
Your percentage chance.
That's the thing, isn't it? Because of course Madrid won the league, and they've only won, I think it's 3 in the last 12 years. So them winning the league was already the shift. The chance of it not being Madrid or Barcelona. Yeah, I think Nicky's the winner here. I think the chance of it not being Madrid or Barcelona, I'd give it maybe 10%. Let's see what happens with the signings. If Luis Suarez turns up at Atletico Madrid and if he's properly fit and properly integrated in the team, then I think that's fairly tasty, actually.
I mean, it is. Could we start then with Spain? Let's start with Suarez going to Atletico. I'm interested in, you know, sort of Barca letting him go there and sort of how big clubs selling to other big clubs in the same country doesn't happen that often, does it? But Suarez and Costa up front is joyous, right?
Well, I don't know if joy is the word that many people would use. I mean, in a way, you've started the question at the right point. You're saying, you know, you're curious about the idea that Barcelona would allow this to happen. I think Barcelona last night, to judge by the reaction of some of the late night radio shows, suddenly realised, oh, hang on a minute. That's Atletico Madrid. They play in our league. They could be... Oh, wait a minute. Shit, they don't play in China. What do we do with this? And there does seem to have been a kind of a sudden realisation from Barcelona, which does make me giggle a little bit. Because apparently the suggestion was that, obviously, look, the fundamental thing from Barcelona's point of view was to try and resolve Suarez's contract situation, even if that meant paying him off up to half of the money that he was owed for the final year and effectively letting him leave as a free agent. But that free agent was going to come with a little asterisk, and the little asterisk was going to say, you know, you don't go to Real Madrid. Not sure who the other teams are suggested, but no one thought of Atletico. And of course, when it starts emerging that it could be Atletico, or it looks very likely to be Atletico, then there is a sudden kind of backing off. And of course, until everything is signed, then that kind of thing needs to be dealt with. Not least because, of course, Barcelona will look at it and say, oh, and this is the other thing that sort of is absurd about this. They were just trying to make him a free agent, and now they realise that means he's going to another club. Oh, maybe we should have a transfer fee for this. Well, yeah, of course he was going to go to another club, no matter what you did. And so there's now going to be some backpedalling. I must admit, I suspect it will probably still go free. I suspect there might be a little bit of tweaking to the agreement, but... We actually don't know yet. But yeah, that's exactly the point, is that you say, well, there's a willingness to sell within Spain, but in a way there kind of wasn't until they... And now they suddenly realise that that was going to be the consequences of the deal they were doing. To put this into some context for you, last summer, James Rodriguez, who, of course, you know, a year on has managed to go on to much bigger and much better things. Last summer, for 60 million euros, James Rodriguez was on the verge of leaving Real Madrid for Atletico Madrid. And then Real Madrid got absolutely destroyed by Atletico in pre-season, conceded 7 goals, and Real Madrid backed down and said no. So, I'm not sure there is that much willing to sell between big clubs as it goes.
I like the idea of Simeone putting his arm around Suarez going, I like you as a player. I just need you to add a bit more, I don't want to say bite, but do you know what I mean?
Yeah, you were about to, weren't you?
I was, yeah. You're just like, just, you know, a bit more needle from you, please, Lewis. That's what we do here at Atleti.
I was going to say, I don't know if this is too much of a forced segue, but I think it's really interesting, this sort of conversation about clubs that are potentially rivals selling to each other, because we've had a situation in Italy that's been just thrown for a loop by the Alvaro Morata signing by Juventus, because it was expected up until yesterday, that Edin Dzeko was going to go to Juventus, and Arkadiusz Milik was going to go from Napoli to Roma to fill Dzeko's old spot, because Napoli have signed Victor Osimhen. But if you were following a lot of the reporting in Italy, there was certainly a sense from some people that Aurelio De Laurentiis, the Napoli owner, was sort of deliberately slowing down this Milik deal because it was convenient to him to disrupt Roma and Juventus, both of whom would be influenced by that first signing. So if Milik doesn't go to Roma, then Roma don't sell Dzeko to Juventus, and you've got two rivals who are sort of inconvenienced by this slow process. Except the Juventus then turn around and go, all right, well, we're going to go and sign Alvaro Morata instead, who personally I think is a better fit for them than Dzeko anyway. I think he's a really nice signing for Juventus for lots of reasons. And suddenly the whole set of dominoes have fallen down. Roma aren't going to get Dzeko off their books, so they can't sign Milik. Napoli, who spent 70 million on Osimhen, now have Milik, who's unhappy, who's refusing to take any sort of reduction on his current wages, even though he's been injured a lot the last couple of years. and I don't have that 30 million euro fee. So you have this sort of reverse domino of because of not wanting to help each other so much in these transfers, that perhaps it's all going to fall apart. But to get back to what you're actually asking about, which is Morata, I mean, I don't know, there's like this feeling of course, you can get trapped by nostalgia in football, and there is a nostalgia factor with Juventus and Morata, because he was very well liked in his 2 years in Turin. I would argue they were two of the better years of his career. Went to a Champions League final the first season, the second season. I still think about that Champions League game against Bayern Munich, which was lost in the sort of most agonising way. I think Juventus were still two goals up when they had Morata on the pitch, and he went off for the last 15 minutes and everything fell apart. I think there's a sense of unfinished business. There's a sense of warmth there that is really mutual between the club and the player. I mean, he met his wife when he was living in Italy. But also, I think tactically, and I'm sure we're going to get into this more with Pirlo soon, I think he probably fits what Pirlo wants much better than Dzeko would have.
In Germany, we don't have any exciting inter-club movements right now. Generally, if there's an exciting inter-club movement, it's somebody going from Dortmund to Bayern over the years. You might have spotted that with Robert Lewandowski, Mario Götze, who managed to destroy his career in the process by going there, etc. But the one question I had of Sid and Nicky was, what is the likelihood of David Alaba being wanted enough that the one of the big guns in their respective countries could pay the money that he wants? Because there's a big contract dispute going on with him at Bayern right now, of him pushing to be one of the top earners, Bayern hitting back saying that if he thinks he's on, so the Bayern sporting director, Hasan Salihamidžić, said that Manuel Neuer and Robert Lewandowski are the top earners at the club. And frankly, David Alaba is not on that level right now. But for me, he's the axis of Bayern at the back. And he's got a year left on his contract, and he doesn't want to go to England. So for me, the only other options would be if, aside from Spain or Italy, was to pay a very hefty sum to Bayern, and then on top of that, pay the wage that Alaba wants.
I mean, I can give a quick answer in that I just don't think there's anyone in Italy who's spending that money right now. Inter have, you know, already had to sort of probably dig a bit deeper than they ideally would have chosen to get sort of the wages sorted for Vidal. They've spent a lot already backing Antonio Conte. With the current market situation with COVID, I don't think they would do it. And likewise, Juventus have spent a lot already on Kulusevski. There's not a club that I see ready to throw big money around for that sort of signing right now.
Yeah, I mean, Barcelona could definitely do with him. But Barcelona don't have the money to make it happen. And Real Madrid in this market, at least, are trying to consolidate their situation both economically and also in sporting terms, you know, maintain the base that they've got. They've been very clear that they are not going to sign. Now, obviously, you never rule out someone doing something at the last minute, but I just don't see it happening at Real Madrid. And not least because Real Madrid will feel that their two centre-backs are secure. It's Ramos and Varane. And if you're looking at Alaba as a left-back still, well, they signed Mendy last year. So there isn't a place for him at those two big clubs. I'm sure Atletico would love him, but there's no way they can afford him either.
Sid, can we talk about Real Madrid and Barcelona? How's Ronald Koeman doing? Is he making everyone happy or unhappy? And does he think he's there for longer than a year? How's it all panning out?
It must be difficult for him to know how to manage that part of his job. As you say, do I act as if I'm here for more than a year, or do I only do the job of a man that knows that I mean, it's not even a year, is it now? What is it, in 9 months' time, I'll be gone? Because there's no way that a continuity candidate will win presidential elections. At least right now, it's very difficult to imagine that. And so he doesn't continue. Unless, I suppose, he does such an amazing job that whoever comes in thinks, actually, I'd better let him continue. Victor Font, who's the favourite to win the elections, although let's see if that changes over time, is absolutely clear that what happens next depends on Xavi Hernandez. And so even if Ronald Koeman was to come and win the treble and be the best team we've ever seen, Xavi Hernandez would still come in and say, bye, Ronnie, have a nice time. So I don't know how he deals with that. In terms of how he's dealing with things so far, well, obviously we've seen him have a series of conversations with players telling them that they're not part of the project. The latest one was Ricky Butch, this week was told that he should go and get some minutes somewhere on loan because he has a long-term future at Barcelona, but not a short-term one because he won't get opportunities. There's been a shift in formation. There isn't any sign at all of any kind of real warmth from Koeman towards players. But then, A, we wouldn't necessarily expect to see that yet. And B, I think there's a bit of a sense that no one wants to see any warmth. That part of the problem was that the players were treated with too much warmth. Now, I think that's a little bit cliched and a little bit facile, but that's certainly the way it is at the moment. So the answer to the question, how has Koeman done? Well, we've only had two friendlies. We don't really know, but he's certainly trying to force people out. The problem is there's an economic reality and it's not so easy to do.
For a second, I thought you said Ricky Butcher. I thought that's quite an interesting, that's an interesting signing.
That would be absolutely magnificent.
How's he getting on with Messi? I saw Messi score a ping with his right foot in that kit that looks like a bottle of Gaviscon. And as the voice of Gaviscon, I wholly approve of that.
Hang on. Whoa. Stop.
Yes, okay.
Are you the voice of Gaviscon?
It soothes enough. Tom and Tim like to eat on the go. But for Tom, it means heartburn. And for Tim, it means indigestion. Sometimes it's the other way around or both.
Unbelievable product placement.
Yeah.
Products must be available, surely.
No, not that I know of.
That is absolutely brilliant.
My most stable employer, to be honest, Sid.
Can you send me a crate of Gaviscon to the house? I need to go in the garage with a ham.
I'll see what I can do. How is Messi? Is he happy? Is he sad?
The only real thing that we've seen to give us any real indication of Messi is the moment when he came off the pitch the other day and shook Koeman's hand. It's been amazing. I mean, genuinely, it's been amazing. I should never admit to watching it. I would almost rather pretend it doesn't exist, but there is a late night TV show that kind of goes on and on and on about very little. And they showed this image from all sorts of different angles. They slowed it down. They zoomed in. They zoomed out again. They stopped and started. They drew a circle around the hands, just in case you don't know what a couple of hands are. And then they got the people on the set and they stood by the big screen and say, look at Koeman. He's looking the other way. And look at his other hand. His other hand is in his pocket. And that's a sign that this isn't real. And I'm thinking, no, it's not. It's a sign that he's scratching his balls surreptitiously. I mean, honestly, it's been analysed and overanalysed. It is true that they shook hands and didn't really look at each other. The classic thing, a player comes off the pitch and, you know, the sort of the sideways on handshake. And they don't really look at each other very much. But I mean, it's such a, you know what? It's a little bit like VAR. It's a fleeting moment, frozen, zoomed in on, replayed over and over and over and over again. And so it looks much more than it really is. And so everyone says, penalty. But it's not a penalty at all. It's just two blokes shaking hands.
I like that Estella's really getting it. This is the, you know, Estella very energised by the handshake, though. It's really
taken
her, hasn't it? What about Real Madrid? They started with a 0-0. Odegaard, Rodrigo and Vinicius Jr. Up top. Were they missing a sort of muscly, quick Welsh winger at all?
Well, I mean, look, at the risk of sounding incredibly opportunistic, and of course it would be incredibly opportunistic, when the post-game discussion is all about, do Real Madrid lack goals? Do Real Madrid lack that ability to kind of have a cutting edge and create very clear chances? For all that they dominate the ball, because they, you know, they were quite neat and tidy. Certainly for about an hour, they were good with the ball. They played okay, but they didn't create a huge amount of real chances. At the risk of being opportunistic, you do look at it and think, you know, James or Bale might have been quite useful in this scenario. I think there's another debate in Spain, though, which has kind of moved beyond that, which is about the number nine position. The fact that Zidane sent on two kids, Arribas and Marvin. Marvin, by the way, who has an amazing story. Marvin comes on, he's a 20-year-old with a Korean mother, a Nigerian father, born in Mallorca, Spanish passport. As a kid, I mean, genuinely as a kid, like I think at the age of 9 or 10, joined Tranmere, played for Tranmere for 3 years. He's a Birkenhead boy. And sorry about that. I mean, they're going to kill me now. One of my mates is from Birkenhead, and I keep saying this to him.
Oh, one of my best friends is a Scouser, so it's all right.
Although, of course, by the way, plenty of Scousers will tell you if you're from Birkenhead, you're not a Scouser.
Yeah, no, I'm aware of that. I'm in trouble too now, that's right.
Yeah. Anyway, so they came on, these two kids in wide positions, rather than putting on Borja Mayoral, Mariano Diaz, or Jovic, and particularly Luka Jovic, who signed last year for 60 million euros, isn't playing. And so the question mark is, do Madrid need a number nine? And of course, the response to this question is, well, they got three of them. Dan doesn't want to play. And so there is that doubt. And look, we talked about this, I think, at the end of last season. Real Madrid won the league last year in a situation in which the second top scorer was Sergio Ramos. there weren't enough goals from the rest of the team, albeit 22 different players scored. So somewhere along the line, you always felt like someone would turn up with a goal, you know, whether it's a fullback or Ramos going up or you know, Varane getting a header or even people like Nacho. But there is still that sense that there is a lack of goals in this team, that there's a lack of ability to make their possession count, which is curious because it's kind of the opposite of what Madrid were under Cristiano Ronaldo. When they didn't always dominate games, they didn't always necessarily impress in the way they played, but you knew the ball would drop and bang, that would be it. The big caveat here is that Hazard at some stage has got to get fit, hasn't he? And Hazard will probably give you 10 or 15 a season if he stays fit. But last year he got one in La Liga.
If you were betting your ham garage on Real or Barca, who would you bet on?
I'd still be betting on Real Madrid because, I mean, Barca, we still don't know how this will be worked through. But you know, genuinely, the situation there is so bad. And Madrid have got stability for all the very small flaws that they have. And yeah, Madrid, I think Madrid are very clear favourites this year.
All right, that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll discuss who's going to win the league in Italy and how much Bayern are going to win the league by in Germany. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Let's look at the title race in Italy then. Nicky, you touched on Pirlo's first game, a pretty straightforward win. What type of manager is he? I mean, every part of me wants him to be Big Sam, you know, just play 4-4-2 and knock it long. Because beautiful footballers don't always, you know, manage beautiful football teams.
No, they don't. I think you're going to be disappointed. That's what you're hoping for. It's fascinating. We've sort of had this crash course in Andrea Pirlo's idea of football because his thesis that he defended literally last Monday to complete the UEFA Pro License course at the Manchester School in Coverciano gave us a bunch of sort of insights. And then we got this first game, which gave us some more insights because it's one thing to sort of write a bunch of ideas down on paper, another thing to actually go out there and play a game. The things that he sort of said in interviews and which were in the thesis and which came out, I think, very clearly in this first game is that he wants to play possession football and he wants to winning the ball back to be a high priority when you lose it. So it's all about the ball. You want to play with the ball, which makes sense, right? This is who we think of as Andrea Pirlo as a player. Juventus was strikingly fast compared to what we saw in the latter period under Maurizio Sarri. Maurizio Sarri, it was bizarre what was going on towards the end with Sarri because he said it over and over again in his press conferences, we move the ball too slowly, and they did. I mean, they were painfully ponderous to watch sometimes last season, but you kept thinking, well, you're the manager, do something about it. And it raises this question of how much the players were willing to go with Sarri last season. It does raise the question of how much they were sort of just not cooperating with his instructions. But Pirlo sort of straight away to encourage the speed that he wants, he threw three kids into the team, really. I mean, you had Weston McKennie, who's this American signing from Schalke, who was really sort of impressive right off the bat in his first game. Dejan Kulusevski was not a surprise in the starting 11. I think he's the one who you would have expected, 20 years old, had a superb season at Parma last season. But then you had Gianluca Frabotta, who is this 21, could be 22, might have that wrong, 21 or 22-year-old left-back who was, as far as most people would have been thinking, the fourth-string left-back coming into this season. He was, obviously, Alexandra is the first choice. Alexandra gets injured. Luca Pellegrini would have been thought of as a second choice, but they're trying to sell him. Even then, people would have assumed Mattia Di Ciglio at left-back. Instead, Pirlo pulls out this left-back from the under-23 team. The under-23 team, who, of course, he was supposed to manage for this summer and lasted all of 9 days there. And Frabotta was really good in his first game as well. And I think that injection of young players, three all at once into the team, certainly had an impact on how the team played and the amount of sort of space and speed and aggression you saw in the team in this game.
I guess the question is, you know, can anyone keep up with them? Inter were only 1 point off last season, but it wasn't quite that close, was it?
No, I mean, it was 1 point. But Juventus had won it with two games to spare, so you could say those last two didn't really matter. I mean, having said that, Juventus barely won a game in the last month of the season. Juventus really were bad. So this idea that if they hadn't won the title already, they would have necessarily won those last two games also feels a bit false to me. It's why this was so sort of striking to see Juventus play well. Because look, Sampdoria, they finished 15th last season. I would be very surprised if they don't finish pretty close to that again this season. They're not that good. Claudio Ranieri, much as I love him, not especially ambitious with his tactics right now. I mean, they lined up in a 4-5-1. They looked better once Fabio Quagliarella came off the bench, but Quagliarella is not in fact ageless. He is slowing down, and the ability for him to sort of fix all their problems is not that high. So it's definitely not one game to get carried away with Juventus. And Inter should be better. I think, I said it before, Achraf Hakimi is such a Conte type of player. Conte's best teams have always had that sort of high tempo, the aggression from the fullback positions. Have had players who get forward from there, overlap and add something to the attack. And Hakimi's going to do that. So Inter should be better. And Vidal, we'll see. I mean, this is what Conte has asked for over and over and over again in his press conferences, experience in the field. Personally, I would have assumed that they signed Sandro Tonali and have the youth and the, I don't know, the option for that young Italian midfielder, Barella, Sensi and Tonali was really exciting to me. But they didn't go that way. They went the way he wanted. He's got what he wants. They have to be in the conversation. Like, they have to be.
Does anyone else have to be in the conversation?
So the team that I've been floating, that I think is not as crazy as some people might, is Milan. Because after the lockdown in Italy, Milan were top of the league. Milan had 30 points, I think, from the last 12 games. There is a certain degree of thinking that this is all about Ibrahimovic. And Ibrahimovic, who's 38 years old, who scored twice in their opener against Bologna on Monday night, is sort of the centre of that. But the reality is he missed a bunch of games in that run in the second half of last season. They had Ante Rebic starting up front, and they were still doing really well. I think they've made a good signing in Tonali. Again, they have a really nice young midfield. Ismail Benacer and Frank Kessié are really developing into, I think, a brilliant, brilliant tandem. And Todd Tonali as well gives them something different. So I think Milan are really interesting. They are definitely some way behind those other two in their development, but I don't think it's inconceivable, if you're looking for a dark horse, that they could become it.
Archie, Bayern Munich. How big a loss is Thiago? Or does it not really matter? I mean, they won 8-0, so it doesn't really matter, does it?
They've been going on about how big a loss as a person he is, particularly Karl-Heinz Rummenigge on a Sunday talk show
on
Sky. Yeah, well, he said that he went to his car in the garage at the Allianz Arena, and there was Thiago waiting for him in his parking spot. And I don't think it was at the Allianz Arena even. I think it was at the training ground anyway. And there Thiago just said goodbye and cried into his arms for 5 minutes. So goes the story per Rummenigge, which is quite sweet.
5 minutes is quite a long time to cry in someone's arms, isn't it? I mean, I don't know if he's overestimated, but I sort of think 30 seconds is quite a long time. Yeah, he cried for 5 minutes and simply said, thank you very much for allowing this.
Yeah, which was, you know, given that Bayern are always painted as being the Death Star of German football, it showed a bit of humanity.
Even from Darth Vader, you know.
Yeah. Darth Vader does have his moments, to be fair. I mean, he did chuck the Emperor down that shaft, you know.
Yeah, that's true. Down the big well or whatever it was, the black hole well. Anyway, carry on, Archie.
We won't know how much Bayern missed Thiago until 6 months' time, I think, because that's when the rotation you would expect will really have kicked in. Right now, everything looks very rosy indeed. Bayern are 31 games unbeaten in all competitions. And of those 31 games, by the way, it's 1-30 and drawn 1. They have 14 back-to-back wins in the Bundesliga. The 8 goals they scored, just for a bit of context, on Friday night, Schalke have scored 9 goals in 2020 as a whole, which is also a big indictment on Schalke. But just the levels that I thought Bayern were able to swagger their way through this game, whether it was the DJ playing a remix of Easy at halftime, whether it was having all three trophies, the Champions League, the DFB Cup, and the Bundesliga at the side of the pitch at the start, just as a little reminder of what they've won recently. But then the performance and the showboating, oh my word. And it was, like, you know, as much as from a neutral perspective, seeing the Death Star succeed like this is not necessarily great for the league. It's entertaining, I have to say. Robert Lewandowski's Rabona was incredible. There was a moment in the first half as well where Serge Gnabry, with a first touch volley, managed to take it past a Schalke player. There is so much to enjoy about the way that Bayern are playing right now. Leroy Sané's debut excellent as well. There's you've got the German tabloid Bild trying to bill his partnership with Serge Gnabry as Snabry, which has raised a lot of groans. Is trying to follow on from the Iron Robin, Franck Ribéry robbery, which I think rolls off the tongue a little bit better. But yeah, at Bayern, apart from the David Alaba contract saga right now, everything is looking rosy, but they've got a lot of games coming up. I think of a possible 35 English weeks, as they call it in Germany, i.e. having to play Saturday, Wednesday, play midweek games. If Bayern get through to the finals of their respective competitions, they will be playing midweek games in 27 of the next 35 weeks, which is a lot. And you need a good squad to be able to cope with that. And the question is, do they have the players beyond that to cope with this? I'm particularly interested to see how they get on against Sevilla on Thursday, because Sid has seen significantly more of Sevilla than I have. But when they came over to Cologne and were playing in the Europa League, what a side, what intensity that they play with. I can't say that I've seen many sides in the Bundesliga play with that kind of intensity. And looking forward to see what challenge they give Bayern on Thursday.
Yeah, I'm quite curious to see that as well. I mean, it feels a bit early, obviously, because they haven't played yet this season. They don't start in La Liga till the weekend. There won't be many significant changes from last season. Obviously, the one really big one is the departure of Ever Banega, and that really obviously matters in the middle midfield. And Lopetegui was saying the other day that there is no one like Banega. We're not going to try and get someone to come in and do a Banega, because you know it's just not going to work that way. The re-signing of Ivan Rakitic means at least they do have a central midfielder who they trust, even if it's not quite the same kind of player, and someone that they kind of glory in. And you know, Nicky was talking earlier about the sense of a homecoming for Alvaro Morata at Juventus. Well, it's exactly the same, or possibly even more so for Rakitic at Sevilla. And I think this is one of the things about them. Sevilla are I know it might be stating the bleeding obvious, but Sevilla are a very well-worked team. They're a team that you can see that what they do on the pitch is the idea that they had in mind. It's not just kind of a consequence of the players who are there. It's a consequence of a plan. That said, I would still be pretty surprised if Bayern weren't significantly better than them.
I wanted to ask about that, the sort of forcing of names together. Like, is that like a long-standing... Because they do that in Italy, right? Like Dybala and Ronaldo, there was Gazzetta for a while really trying to force the Dybaldo thing that didn't really sort of take off with fans. And like, I remember when in previous editions of Milan, they were trying to do Caparo with Kaká, Pato and Ronaldinho. Oof. And I'm now sort of doing it with Premier League players in my head. So like, could we have Aubameyang?
Like a bam?
Is it
like a
bam?
Le Cabayang or Obama Gzet? I don't know which is...
When Robert Lewandowski and Thomas Müller scored a combined 50 goals for Bayern a few seasons ago, I remember people trying to get Mulandowski off the ground.
Oh, which, I like that.
Yeah.
Obviously, if you put Harry Kane and Gareth Bale, you get Bane, don't you? Which is quite a ruthless striker.
I hate to say it, but obviously here they do it with the initials instead. So obviously, famously, it was Bale, Benzema, and Cristiano, the BBC. Then at Barcelona, it was the MSN. Obviously, Messi, Suarez, and Neymar. And then they tried to do this at Celta when it was Aspas and Nolito, and who was the other one? And Orellana. And I can't remember for the life of me remember what they came up with. All I can remember is it was Aspas Nolito Orellana, which is ano, which is anus.
I was just thinking, you either go Bane or you go kale, which is it's a very very gentrified sort of smoothie ingredient for Tottenham fans. Archie, can I ask you about Dortmund and RB Leipzig? Dortmund first, they keep getting younger and better, don't they? I mean, Jude Bellingham has sort of started brilliantly, and Sancho is still there. Do we still think he's going to be there in a month's time?
Yes. Yeah. The way he's playing, he's playing fully committed, and that point is being reiterated by Dortmund as well. The age that you have to be to get into Dortmund's attacking lineup right now is 20 or under. That was the note that was being made by Kicker Magazine over here, because you've got Erling Haaland, 20, Gio Reyna, 17, Jadon Sancho, 20 as well, and Jude Bellingham not far behind them at 17. And the way that that Gio Reyna, in particular, son of Claudio Reyna, of course, former...
Oh, your voice just broke. That's nice, actually. Yeah.
It's not the first time.
before Gio's did, presumably.
Yeah, exactly. he's really come on, and it looks like this is going to be the season where he's going to really shine. And the pace that Dortmund have going forward, you saw it with their third goal they scored against Gladbach. I should say, as a whole, the game was pretty even, pretty balanced. But as Marco Rose, the Gladbach coach, said, Dortmund were just more effective than Gladbach. And with that third goal where Erling Haaland is in his own box and then 10 seconds later he's finishing off a move where Jadon Sancho has run basically the length of the pitch with the ball, frightening pace. And Max, you mentioned how young Dortmund are. Just be wary of a guy called Youssoufa Moukoko, who I've mangled his name there. Moukoko, there we go. He'll be 16 in November and has been tearing it up for Dortmund at youth level for the past few years. He started playing for Dortmund's under-17s when he was 12 and has scored 90 goals for them in 56 games.
Wow. Bloody
hell. He scored 37 in 22 games for their under-19s, including a 16-minute hat-trick this weekend. So Erling Haaland has already said that Moukoko is better than he was when he was 16. So they've got quite a player coming through behind them as well. And to think that in this Dortmund lineup, Julian Brandt and Marco Reus couldn't get into this team right now, that speaks of a certain depth. But to your earlier question of what does this mean for a title race, you have to get over 80 points to challenge Bayern. And if you look at the best points tallies in Bundesliga history, like the top six right now are six of Bayern's last eight title wins. Right. You have to perform with an incredible consistency that I don't think any other club can right now.
Like the idea that Erling Haaland is past it, you know, he's looking at people younger. I'll join the vets team. What about Leipzig? They replaced Timo Werner.
Alexander Zorlot, who's currently owned by Crystal Palace, I believe, had a very good season in Turkey, is very close to signing on the dotted line there. They've also got a striker called Huang, who they've got in from RB Salzburg. I'm not sure how they managed to scout him. But otherwise, you wouldn't say... Thanks, I'm glad you got it.
I'm still sitting here.
Julian Nagelsmann will adapt the style because Zorlot is not the striker that Timo Werner is, a quick, speedy player in behind. Julian Nagelsmann loves to have a big physical forward, whether it was Ishak Belfodil when he was working at Hoffenheim, Joel Linton, for example, Adam Solai as well. And he's already got one in Yusuf Poulsen, but I think that we're going to see Leipzig adapting their play a little bit more. And the way that Julian Nagelsmann is, the tactical gift that he has, you can just kind of see him rubbing his hands with glee, like, yes, I've got to work out something new here. So, yeah, Leipzig will still be a coming force in the league, but I think we'll still see them behind Dortmund and Bayern. They started with a 3-0 win, we should say. Sorry, a 3-1 win against Mainz at the weekend. And, yeah, looked decent, but Mainz are one of my relegation candidates.
Right. Well, we'll do more sort of relegation candidates and other fun, generic questions that you can impress your friends in the pub with until 10 p.m. or when we're not allowed to go to pubs anymore on Zoom for lockdown 2, all in part 3. Welcome to part 3 of the Guardian Football Weekly. I'd written down lots of sort of generic questions about all the leagues. And Sid, you did a piece about... old players in La Liga and people going, oh, that's where he is. And that's the thing I'm probably most interested in is players that I want to go, he's still playing. He's still there. Yeah. He's doing this. And you wrote a piece about it. So if you could just read it out for us now.
I'll read it out for you. Well, I'll tell you the ones that I enjoyed. And not just that they're a bunch of old players, but it's a bunch of old players who've nearly all been in England. So on the weekend when Manuel Pellegrini took Betis to joint top alongside Granada at the top of the table, Granada went top with their first goal in a 2-0 win, scored by the extraordinarily fast. That's the thing that I couldn't believe. It was literally just a ball up the pitch. Whoosh! You go, shit, is that Roberto Soldado running at 34 kilometres an hour at the age of 35? So Roberto Soldado scored this weekend. Iago Aspas, another former Premier League legend and glorious corner taker, scored two more. I mean, to be fair, Aspas is not a story, him scoring, because genuinely, and I know that everybody always responds with the extraordinarily hilarious corner response, but Aspas genuinely has been probably the single most important player for his club in Spain over the last 4 or 5 years. You know, the Celta have a dependence on Aspas that possibly even Barca don't have with Messi. It's extraordinary. He has been absolutely brilliant since he's been back at Celta. He scored two brilliant goals at the weekend. Middlesbrough legend Kike Garcia scored for Eibar. You had Alvaro Negredo scoring the first goal that Cardiff have scored in the First Division for 15 years at the weekend. Alvaro Negredo is also 35. Of course, you had David Silva coming on for Real Sociedad at 35. And you know, I obviously maths is not really my strong point, but you got Negredo, Soldado, and Aspas between them are more than 100 years old, and they all scored at the weekend. I also did this. I went through the scoring. Admittedly, you know, you got three games missing because some teams haven't started yet. But more than 50% of the goals in La Liga this weekend were scored by people over 30. Only two of the goals in La Liga were scored by people under 27 or under 28, I think it was. So it was a weekend for old guns at the time at which, of course, Madrid were playing with a forward line that was 19, 20 and 21. And they replaced two of them with an 18-year-old and a 20-year-old. But yeah, all the old guys.
And producer Jack pointed out, Shinji Okazaki is at Huesca. I love that. I loved Okazaki.
I mean, I've not actually seen him play yet this season, not this season. But there was to take that on a bit, everyone got very excited here because in the Eibar Villarreal game, there were three Japanese players. And they were, wow, this is huge for the Japanese market. To be honest, I doubt it really was.
Is there a similar rundown in Italy, Nicky? Are there sort of, former Premier League players clogging away that we've forgotten exist?
I feel like there's undoubtedly like loads who I'm just not thinking of. The names popped into my head as Sid was talking. The most obvious one is, of course, Zlatan, who is 38 years old and just dominated against Bologna. He was in very, very Zlatan form after the game, saying, oh, if I was still 20 years old, I would have scored four goals tonight. But he said, but I'm 39, so I only scored two. And he went, hang on a second, I'm 38. So he actually didn't even know his own age, which is good.
How good is he still?
So, like, he's definitely, of course, slowed down from where he was. And it's really hard to measure him in a game like this where Milan were very on top for basically the entire game. He was a ton of fun to watch. I mean, that's the sort of the best answer I think I can honestly give you. If you watch this game, the flicks he's making, the sort of audacious touches that he's pulling off, none of that has gone anywhere. He's obviously still in very good physical shape. He's not very fast, but he's a player you can use without necessarily relying on explosive pace. And he was never really based his game on pace anyway.
That was never him, was it?
Exactly.
And I remember when Barcelona, there's a nice line, when Barcelona signed him, part of the idea was obviously this idea of the plan B, that, you know, you've got to have someone that when you need it, you can put the ball in the box. Someone who can, as the Spanish phrase has it, someone who can fix the two centre-backs, you know, have the two centre-backs on him, mm-hmm. that open space either side of him. And there was a lovely line from Juan Malillo, who, of course, is now the assistant manager to Guardiola at Man City. And Juan Malillo's line was, Zlatan Ibrahimovic gives mouth-to-mouth resuscitation to every move. You know, when it looks like the move is dying, when it looks like it's breaking down, boom, to Zlatan. And he suddenly gives kind of oxygen to everyone around him. And that there's no reason why he shouldn't be able to still do that.
Absolutely. And I mean, we were just talking about the Japanese players. It's a 21-year-old defender, Tomiyasu, playing for Bologna, who honestly, Zlatan took him for a ride. I mean, some of the moments, this guy looked like his head was spinning in circles. And yeah, you know, I think Milan aren't dependent on him. I think they've got other options, but he's certainly a presence when he's there. The other one from this weekend, still starting up front for Genoa, Goran Pandev, who's one of those players who I just don't think that everyone sort of registers in the same way as some other names, was really important to Inter's team that won the treble. Like, he was a really important player in that treble-winning side for Inter. And the fact that he's not as old as Zlatan, he's getting on, but he's not as old as Zlatan. The fact that he's sort of having this late career sort of run a club that's barely scraped to survival last season, and every now and then doing things that look like a treble winner might do, like he's got a really, really nice chip at the weekend, is just sort of one of those sorts of weird, old players still hanging around doing great things stories.
and Ragnar Klavan, who played 39 times for Liverpool. I barely registered in my mind, even though I was definitely doing this job while he was there. He's still turning up for Calgary. How about in the Bundesliga? I mean, everyone seems under 20, Archie. So are there any sort of ancient old dogs still doing it?
It's not on the playing side, but do you remember David Wagner?
Yes, of course. He's doing great things, isn't he?
He's pretty much on the precipice now. I spoke to him after Bayern's 8-0 shellacking of his Schalke team, and he didn't seem all that bothered. He didn't seem as concerned as I thought he would, given the fact that this was the second biggest defeat in Schalke's history. And the way that his Schalke side capitulated, I put it to him whether his side didn't have the same fight as his Huddersfield side, because that's how I remember that team, and he disagreed. But to my eyes, this Schalke side, which has a lot more quality in it than that Huddersfield side that he has, lots of solid Bundesliga pros on paper, just collapsed. And that's now 17 games without a win for Schalke. It's said that they had a big problem with injuries at the end of last season, which is true. But equally, because of the massive financial problems that Schalke are having, they've had a 40 million euro bailout from the local state, for example. The fact is, they're having to use players such as Steven Skripski, Sebastian Rudi, Ralf Fährmann on loan at Norwich. Remember him? He only played once. Mark Oot and Nabil Bentaleb. There's another player. There's two more at least. Problem is, these are players that Wagner did not want last season. And he's now having to be like, oh, hi, guys. So you are now forming the basis of my team. And I didn't see a side that was really playing for him. There's already talk of him being replaced. Ralf Rangnick is a potential replacement as well. That is if they lose to Werder Bremen this Saturday. I thought fans were going to be in the stadium, but the rate of corona, of the coronavirus has really risen in Gelsenkirchen, so unlikely for there to be fans there. I would say also unlikely that David Wagner is going to be coach at Schalke for too much longer.
A couple of quick questions for you, Sid. One is about Kepa Arrizabalaga, who's obviously in the headlines a lot now. Do Bilbao fans and La Liga viewers generally think that Chelsea were done out of 70 million?
No. I think they think that something's happened, and they don't fully understand it. Because, look, I think with Kepa, that there was a sense of getting excited maybe a bit too quickly about him. You know, that immediately there was like, wow, here's this young kid who comes into the Athletic team at a time when maybe there'd been some doubts about other goalkeepers, and at a club which in theory at least has a tradition of really good goalkeepers, or at least the Basque country supposedly has a tradition of good goalkeepers, and people always talk about Iribar, and they talk about Luis Arconada at Real Sociedad and so on. And so I think there was, if you like, a willingness to get excited maybe a bit too quick. But when he came through, although it's true that there were one or two mistakes, there was a sobriety about him and a calmness about him and occasionally really good saves about him that people thought, yeah, this guy is going to be very good. And Luna, don't forget that had it not been for Zidane basically, you know, sticking his heels in and saying, I'm not doing this, he would have gone to Real Madrid. You know, this is someone that everybody assumed was going to be a really good goalkeeper. When he went to Chelsea, while it's true that everyone thought, well, that's a lot of money and that's great for Athletic Bilbao, it was actually greeted as a pity, not as a, hey, brilliant, we've conned that lot. And so, while it's true that there were flaws in his game, and while it's true that he was very young and that possibly the pressure would have played a part, he'd seemed very, very level-headed. He, you know, this is someone who gets into the Spain team. The debate in Spain about goalkeepers was absolutely not about him. It was about De Gea and how bad De Gea was and how Kepa had to be the Spanish goalkeeper. So watching this, I don't know if I'd call it a decline I suppose it is a decline. But what I mean is watching him not perform for Chelsea, but not only that, but get worse. There seems to be a spiral downwards now. I think has provoked a kind of a sadness more than anything else, rather than a sense that Chelsea got conned here. There is a doubt now about, well, what's happened. Why has it reached this point?
Another question, just to Wolves, who lost to City 3-1 last night, but actually put up a pretty good second half contest. Nelson Semedo's coming in. How excited should Wolves fans be about that?
I am really undecided about Semedo, because this is going to sound very... Well, maybe it's not going to sound very stupid, but he's clearly got a lot of things. He's quick. His use of the ball isn't bad. He's a player that I think on the face of it could be very good. But honestly, I'm struggling to remember a good performance for Barcelona from him. In fact, the two or three good ones I can think of were when he played as an emergency left back rather than on the right on his natural side. I'm struggling to remember a performance where I thought for 90 minutes he was really, really good, to the extent that Sergio Roberto, who I know has become a right back, but in theory is still a midfielder, has in truth been the better right back for Barcelona. And that's not to say he's been brilliant. And so there's a bit of me that thinks, in the right team, with the right context and the structure around him working, can he be good? Yeah, absolutely he can. But I'm not sure if he is yet.
And did you know, more importantly, that former Luton Town and Nottingham Forest winger Kingsley Black owns a charcuterie in Mallorca?
I did not know that, and I now want to go.
Well, I was wondering, I think we discussed it on the pod yesterday, you could compare hams, you could take one to him and compare them. I don't know.
We could have a fight with the hams. Have you seen the film Jamón Jamón?
I haven't, but I'd love to.
The fight scene with the hams is absolutely magnificent.
Kingsley Black's charcuterie sounds like an upmarket response to Lucas Podolski's kebab shop.
It does, yeah, doesn't it? I'd like the idea, Sid, of you just getting on a plane in your hand luggage, just being a ham.
With a ham slung over my ham slung over my shoulder. I mean, you know, it's basically the scene is effectively a sword fight with hams. It's quite magnificent.
Excellent. Well, that's something for us all to do after we finish the pod, which is right now. Thank you so much, all of you, for your time. Thank you, Nikki.
Thanks.
Thank you, Archie.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sid.
Pleasure.
We'll be back on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.